Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
This episode contains discussion around suicide. Listener discretion is advised. Hey, Alarmy, check out Alarmist on Patreon for ad-free episodes and bonus content. Here's a preview of our Guest Alarmist series, only on Patreon. That really?
He's the inventor of the flush toilet. Yeah, John Crapper.
No, yeah. You're kidding. She's kidding.
Yeah,
no.
I'm looking at it. I'm serious. I'm not
John
joking.
Crapper is the inventor of the flush toilet.
John Crapper, Thomas. Stop. He was
Oh, that's why crap is crap.
Yeah.
Go to patreon.com/thealarmist and subscribe today. Now on to our episode. Each week we decide who's to blame for a historical tragedy. And each week you tell us if we got it right. My name is Rebecca Delgado Smith, and this is The Aftermath. The Aftermath. Hey everyone, thanks for tuning into this episode of The Aftermath. Today we're speaking with guest expert, Dr. Arjun Rama. Dr. Rama is a private practice psychiatrist in Madison, Wisconsin. He is affiliated with the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and has written the article, A Modern Tragedy from a Mental Health Perspective, about Kurt Cobain. Let's hear what he has to say about the death of the Nirvana frontman. Dr. Rama, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So can you start off by giving us a brief overview of Kurt Cobain's upbringing? What was his childhood like? How did his parents' divorce affect him?
Sure. So I feel like to situate Kurt Cobain, you have to start a little bit with geography. You know, we talk about the Seattle sound and Seattle, Washington, and that's so much of his story. But Kurt was actually raised in Aberdeen, Washington, which is about an hour and a half to 2 hours away. And it's significant because, you know, this was the 70s and 80s. This is a pre-internet time. In a lot of ways, you know, you could be, it's as much as being like on another planet relative to the cultural experience of Seattle. And so going from quite, you know, liberal in Seattle to quite conservative where he was from. And it was about as far as you'd imagine a artistically bright boy to be coming from, because the main industry was logging. It was very much a blue collar middle class town, and was actually really struggling at the time that he was coming up. So Kurt wasn't necessarily from means, but his early development, as I read about it and understand it, is that this was a loved child. I mean, he was raised by two parents who cared about him. His initial appearance on the scene, I think he was the firstborn. So it was like that new kid excitement that a family has, first child excitement. And the thing about him that was explosive right away was this was an artistically brilliant young person. The sense that people had, you know, and what we know him about is music. But my God, he was a visual artist first. And I mean, this, I encourage our listeners to listen or to look up online drawings that he did as a child. You'll be astounded at what he was doing at age 2, 3, 4. So really precocious that way, but also engaging in singing and playing the guitar a little bit, and definitely playing the drums. He was like a, you know, banging on pots and pans kind of kid. So well-loved, excitable, I think, to the point where in there was concerns about ADHD for him, and he was treated for that early, unsuccessfully, like a lot of kids were in the 70s before we got better treatments, better diagnosis and management. But apart from that, it was really, it seemed to me, based on reading the biographies about him, that it was quite positive. Until, as you mentioned, Rebecca, like this divorce at age 9. And his biographer, Michael Azarad, in his excellent, excellent book, Come As You Are, he says, you know, that was where it seemed like a light went out for him. And then I think something began at the beginning of adolescence for him that was quite different, where he became withdrawn. He was upset that his parents, not only that they split, but that they partnered up with people that he also didn't like. And in many ways begins a more sullen period that overlaps with his adolescence, where so many people have a sullen period anyways. I think it was compounded by this divorce. He becomes defiant, hard to handle, to the point where he kind of gets shuttled between parents, and even as a teenager at times lives either near homeless or actually homeless, couch surfing with friends and family. And I think it brings up a big theme for him in his life that was, you know, feeling ashamed of this divorce and ashamed of his circumstances. So that's kind of an overview, roughly, you know, of his development. But there's so much more detail, of course.
Of course, yeah. But at what point then do we see that his we see his substance abuse begin? And in your experience as a psychiatrist, where do many of these substance abuse issues stem from?
You know, it was very typical in some ways. He started smoking marijuana at age 13. It seems like it continued throughout his adolescence, which is a really tough time because the brain is doing so much development. And in fact, at some point, he remarks in an interview, he said, you know, all this, people told us it was so harmless, marijuana, especially coming out of the 60s. But he attributed sometimes feeling like he didn't have a good memory as a result of it. That his short-term memory was bad. And that's consistent, actually, with significant young cannabis use. And I think, from what I understand, it was pretty high volume, although that's hard to verify. But apart from that, it seems like he was certainly a trier of drugs. And he was trying hallucinogens like LSD quite early as well. So I think that there could have been significant changes as a result of that. And your question about where did these things come from, that's a really hard one. So I would say, you know, I like to break things down, and this is what psychiatrists tend to do, which is, you know, the biologic underpinnings, the social and psychological underpinnings. Biologically, there was definitely some substance use, meaning genetically, other folks in his family were using drugs, or rather had used and had been alcohol dependent in some of his I think maybe grandparents, but there were other primary, you know, there were other family members. But then I think that when you look at the way that he was trying to experience, and this is the social psychological elements of it, I think he was trying to get away from the shame of this divorce, feeling misunderstood or poorly understood. He was a very physically small person in a place where, he was definitely, I think maybe less than or around 5'7", less than that, but very also very a petite person in a place where physical prowess, you know, athletic ability was really valued. The main industry was a very physical industry, which is what logging is. And so I suspect that he was trying to anesthetize and get himself away from these feelings and his social environment, that's not unusual either.
And so Kurt turns to music as a teenager. He starts multiple bands, eventually founds Nirvana with a fellow high schooler. Chris Novoselic. And in many ways, music was Kurt's lifeline, but also, as we learn later on, it was a major contributing factor to his problems. So good and bad, all of it. How did the rock and roll lifestyle put a strain on Kurt's obstacles as his rise in fame happened?
Well, so two things. I want to preface this by saying, you know, I know about Kurt Cobain from reading about him, but I never knew him. And so much of good psychiatry is, do you know the patient or the person in front of you? So I'm going to comment about this based on what I know. And coming back to the idea about music, maybe as something that's helpful or music as something that's harmful, I'm going to push back on the idea that it was harmful. I think rock and roll music saved Kurt Cobain. I don't think we would have had him as long as we did. This was a lifeline for him to get out of a situation where he felt stulted, you know, limited. Chris Novoselic was somebody who was also a music enthusiast. So he had the kind of brother in this way. And they were like a brothers throughout his life. And Kurt had been had made some suicide attempts, had suicidal thinking all through his teens. I don't know if he would have gotten through high school without music. Then to come to the idea about the rock and roll lifestyle, Nirvana was not a rock and roll lifestyle band. They were kind of anti, like they were pushing back against like the hair metal bands that were, you know, excited about excess. And I mean, you know, they were punks at core. And so they were smashing instruments. They were destroying hotel rooms. They were doing the punk stuff. But, you know, Kurt was a ardent feminist. So there were not, there weren't, you know, women hanging around post shows. It was none of this kind of Def Leppard, Poison kind of style of rock music. But I will say one aspect of being a wealthy musician, and he was only wealthy for the last 2.5 years of his life, he was impoverished most of his life, is that I think it did give him some access to drugs. And I think that the access to drugs was significant because heroin being more expensive and difficult to obtain, now he had people who wanted to, in order to get in with him, because he was so influential, that perhaps in that way we could look at it as a rock and roll lifestyle. That caused more problems for him. But I want to say to your listeners, you know, and everybody, I think rock music kept him alive for much longer than we would have him.
And you touched on this a little bit earlier, yeah. But in an interview, there's his fellow band member, Chris, describes Kurt as being very sensitive to feeling embarrassed, right?
Yes.
Very obviously, all of us, nobody wants to be embarrassed.
Yes.
But to him, it felt like this was on a different level and it would manifest into anger. What is this? Is there a connection between shame and anger, and how can you see it manifest in Kurt and his life?
So, you know, I'll take it like this. There are so many theories about the way that shame manifests, but I'm a psychoanalyst, so I like to look at, you know, what can the ego do, the self, manage? And I think that some people become ashamed and they're able, or they've got ways of managing it that could be perhaps less harmful and less problematic. But I think for Kurt, the way that his psyche was arranged based probably on development and constitutional factors, inheritance and all that, I do think it came out as intense anger. Not so much in terms of the smashing of instruments and things like that, not in ways that I think were, you know, really obvious. But I think that sometimes it led him to do things that would be kind of withholding. He would get even withholding of the audience. If he was playing in a place where he felt he wasn't understood, there was one large show they did in South America where he felt the crowd was humiliating the opening act that they'd had, which was an all-female act. And as a feminist, he was really hurt by it. And I believe that that was the show where, you know, he would They played terribly kind of on purpose. They wouldn't play Smells Like Teen Spirit. So there were these ways in which his feeling ashamed about the people's perceptions of him that would come out in kind of passive aggressive ways. But, you know, I hope I'm answering that question. It's a little bit broad, but everybody, I think, handles shame differently. And I think it depends a lot on their makeup. But for Kurt, I think it was either anger that goes outwards and then often also anger that goes inwards, too.
Now, he and his wife, Courtney Love, were said to have this very tumultuous relationship. And she was a self-proclaimed junkie at the time. How could this relationship have contributed to his harmful cycle?
So, you know, again, I think coming from a psychoanalytic perspective on how people function, I think that the real difficulties that got Kurt into trouble happened much earlier, way before he met his wife. This would be the stuff we were talking about: humiliation at the divorce, difficulty in social circumstances, not feeling unsupported, feeling cast out in high school. Just like how I don't think rock and roll killed Kurt, I don't think that his wife did either. In fact, I think, and this is something that Frances Bean Copain mentions in an interview somewhere, I think they were really in love with each other. And I think that they were a good fit in some ways, but also they both had a sincere and severe drug problem. So they were both enabling also. So I would say that it was tumultuous. I think it was artistically supportive. The lyrics and complexity of Nirvana's In Utero album, I think that that was supported by the fact that he had an artist with him who was encouraging him to do things more elaborately. However, I do think that they were, especially in 1992, and which is right after Nirvana's Nevermind comes out, they were doing a lot of drugs. And I think that it was also a way to escape from him trying to manage his career. But so it's a mixed bag with his wife, I think.
Yes, and she obviously took a lot of the blame when around the time of his death. I feel like you were already speaking to this.
Yes.
But are there situations where this kind of relationship could actually help, it could have helped him turn his life, or is there a version of his life where Courtney comes in and things take a turn for the better?
Well, you know, let me back up for a second too, because I think the period of time is really important. I think a lot of the bashing of his wife was 90s era sexism that I think mirrors 1970s era sexism that happened with Yoko Ono and John Lennon. There's, I think, a myth of the male creative genius that is being taken over or sucked dry, you know, by some kind of witch figure. I think that happened to Yoko, and I think that happens to Courtney also. And also, the thing is that people, to answer your second question about this, not only are the women in these relationships viewed as like witches when they're bad, they're supposed to also be saviors on the other side, which is, I don't think that there was much that Yoko was going to do to preserve the Beatles. And similarly, I don't think there was much Courtney was going to do to preserve Kurt Cobain and Nirvana. Like I said, my sense of people's psychopathology and problems, he was running into problems way before he met her. And it's well documented: suicide attempts, suicide thoughts, drugs, everything. So I don't think that there's a world where Courtney Love could have done something that would have turned the tide on this problem. He was cruising for a disaster for a very long time. Even for a young person. Yeah. He was only 27, and I think he was sick for a very long time, actually.
Wow. Now, just 12 days before his death, authorities are called to Kurt's home, and they had multiple guns confiscated.
Yes.
Is there more that the authorities could have done to prevent him from still gaining access to a shotgun, which he later uses?
Yeah.
And what are the protocols or measures taken in these circumstances?
It's very state by state. A first thing I'll say is, you know, I praise the idea or the fact that guns were confiscated, because that's the way that men commit suicide, is with guns. However, Kurt's a smart guy. The way that he got his gun was he just asked his friend to go buy it for him. That it was that simple. So Kurt Cobain actually did not buy the gun. His friend Dylan Carlson bought it for him. And the thing about that is that speaks to the gun problem we have broadly in this country. It shouldn't be so easy to get guns. And it doesn't, you know, the fact that there are lists and there are waiting periods, and that's all good. But if we just didn't have access to shotguns or really any guns as easily as we do, we wouldn't have the number of suicides that we have. And I'm not even saying cutting it down to zero. If it just wasn't so damn easy to get them, you could make movement on those numbers. So I think that isn't an exact protocol or measure. It's just that if we had less guns available, we'd have less suicides. And I don't think anyone would disagree with that.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
A lot can happen in 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
In the days before his death, Kurt's friends say that they staged an intervention to get him into treatment.
Yeah.
Obviously, this doesn't work. But how fragile can these interventions be? How fraught are they? And why do you think this one in particular didn't work at that time?
You know, I admire people who do these interventions, because I think it really is an attempt to do the right thing. The fact that it didn't work probably has more to do with the issue that these were deep psychological issues. The train was already out of the station by this point. Kurt had already attempted suicide when Nirvana was in Europe at this point. The thing is that perhaps this could have been more helpful, but it was not well reported, or maybe not reported at all, I don't think, that his suicide attempt in Rome, Italy, just beforehand was an attempt. It wasn't an overdose. I wonder if people might have been more aggressive with him at that time, because the period of time after a person attempts suicide is so dangerous. He was so at risk and probably, or no, certainly should have been hospitalized psychiatrically, but he was managed for a combination of benzodiazepine and alcohol overdose. And the thing is, some of this, I think, speaks to the fact that people didn't want to believe just how ill he was. There was many incentives. And I think some, and those people at that intervention, to my mind, were really well-meaning. I mean, they wanted him to do well. So I wonder if the intervention was kind of doomed because he was already in such bad shape by that point.
Now, in our episode, we discussed the 27 Club, which is the age that that raises, many rock stars and artists have passed. What is it about this age that raises the possibility of a tragedy like this? Or do you think it's just a coincidence?
You know, the part of me that is kind of likes to romanticize things, I wish it was something special. I don't think it is. I think it's just, I think it's a coincidence. These are often people who have met with a certain level of intense success. Because I think about, you know, Hendrix, Morrison, all these people, they're not new to being, or it's not, you know, just 2 seconds ago that they became famous. But I if we're being scientific about it, there's nothing special about that number. It is a weird coincidence, though. I can see why people are fascinated by it. I wish I could say that there was something special about it, and then that would be helpful for other people. But no, I think it's a total coincidence.
So it's not like a developmental, I guess it's your or something about the stress of 20s. I don't know. Well, I'm trying to make things up.
No, you know? I think you're, you know, I think you're on the right track to at least, let's put it this way. You know, early adulthood, which I would still consider, I would say young adulthood. I would still consider a 27-year-old young adult. It's still tumultuous. You know, we've learned so much about the way the brain is really developing deep into our 20s. So the tragedy of the 27 Club is, I always wonder, I'm like, well, you know, if there'd been an intervention, what would it have been like if he'd had a little bit more time to develop? What would he have been like at 37? And often we find that people, you know, who can live a little longer, have a chance to get some treatment under their belt. You know, we may not be in this position. So, yeah, it's a tragedy, but I think it's a coincidence.
Mm. Now, I read that the suicide hotlines almost doubled with callers at the time of Kurt Cobain's death. How did his death impact his fans? And in terms of mental health, what have we learned or grown as a society after this tragedy?
Well, I'll use myself for this. So I was 12 years old when Kurt Cobain died. And I was just like every other 12-year-old, 13-year-old. I was watching MTV, and then Kurt Loder comes on. By the way, I don't know how old you are, if you remember this era, but Kurt Loder comes on TV and he tells, you know, kids, like, you know, your favorite musician just committed suicide with a shotgun. It was really, it was one of those times where you suddenly realize that life itself is much more fragile. And that for me, my sense about people who had psychological problems, they were people who were homeless on the street, hallucinating, psychotic. I couldn't believe that a person who, in my opinion, I mean, he had it all. And, you know, he had the both artistic and commercial attention that every artist wants. He was still young when he had it. So I think for people from my generation who took this in, it was a sense of these things can happen to anybody and that we are all vulnerable. I think it opened up a conversation about mental health. I talked to my parents that night about this situation, and even my dad, who I didn't think would know much to say about this, he said, you know, thoughts about suicide, you know, it's more common than you think. People do think about these things. And that was kind of eye-opening to me. I just thought as a kid, I thought that only extremely obviously sick people would do things like this, you know. But then you watch a person who, you know, on many measures had it all. It was, I think, a eye-opening thing. I can tell that we're in a much different era right now, where we have people like Simone Biles taking a couple years off for mental health concerns and trying to take that into consideration, even if it's bad for your career. So I wouldn't say that there's a direct line between what's happening in 2024 and what happened back in 1994. But I think that it opened up the conversation for people because it was so big when it happened.
I feel like it's important for us to kind of know what to do in moments of crisis.
Yeah.
What would you, as a professional, recommend? I guess both sides. If you feel like you're going through, you're experiencing this kind of moment, or if you feel like a loved one might be.
So, I think that approaching it without hesitation. I wonder about that with Kurt. I think that people were like, well, should we address this head on? Is it bad for his career? Is it going to be even further humiliating for him? Talking about suicide, using the word suicide, doesn't make people kill themselves. You know, there's a sense of like, oh, if we hit the nail on the head, it's going to be too intense. If anything, if you feel like your friend is talking about things that make you concerned, you can address it directly with them if you feel comfortable. And we have the 988, which is the new emergency number for it, calling that to get assistance. I think about this like, don't let this problem happen alone. If you don't feel comfortable addressing a friend, call somebody and be direct with them. Even if you're going to be telling them details that you wonder, gee, they're going to be upset to know that I talked to somebody about your suicidal discussion. But the thing is, this is how we lose people, is usually in secrecy like that. So then if it's the person who themselves is experiencing it, please call 988. Do that right away. And also, if that's not your thing, tell somebody. Tell as many people as you feel like you can manage, because your life is quite literally on the line. There's not a lot that I really hate in the whole world, but I really hate suicide because I can't help. We can do a lot for people psychiatrically, and people can lose so much. But the thing we cannot do, we cannot manage a person after they kill themselves. I know that sounds so obvious, but that's the thing. It bothers me. And I think that this situation, we're talking about Kurt Cobain today, but he's a good example of where I think more and maybe with greater interventions, we wouldn't even be having this conversation, which would be nice.
Yeah. So we ask all of our guest experts the same question.
Sure.
I'm curious what you'll say. At the end of the day, if you had to pick a person or thing, it could be a concept that you think is to blame for the death of Kurt Cobain, who or what would that be?
It's an easy one, and it's not as specific as perhaps people would like, but it's broader. It's shame. I really think it was shame. He and so many people came to a situation in life with biological predispositions, psychological situations, social situations, but it was a difficulty in managing and tolerating the shame and perhaps even impending shame that was coming to him. So some of the details at the end for him was things were getting very complex for Nirvana. He was concerned about actually a possible lawsuit related to the concept for the Heart Shaped Box video. And he was only wealthy for a couple of years. Most of his life, he had nothing. And so he was worried about being sued for everything. It seems like he was also concerned of whether his marriage was going to continue and that if he was going to be having more problems. And then he was also feeling like he was never, there was a certain hopelessness about ever escaping heroin addiction. He tried really, really hard, and he wrote really desperately about it in his journals. But it was like a sense of, am I ever going to get away from this? Now, all those problems we can work with. But I think that there was an internal sense of being so humiliated by what had already happened, and then a sense of new humiliations into the future, that I think his ego, his self, it could not manage it. And in that way, it's not so much that, this is why I push back at the idea about partners should have been doing more, or rock and roll was the problem, or fame was the problem, or money was the problem, because we know so many people out there who have all those things and stressors, and they manage it. But I think for this man and for so many people, it was shame. That's at the end of the day, that was the big problem.
Dr. Rama, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you for having me. It was great.
We're going to head over to Patreon now and discuss further. So we invite our listeners to come. If you'd like to hear our post-interview discussion and final verdict, head over to Patreon and subscribe. Your support is greatly appreciated. Check out our show notes for a link or head over to patreon.com/thealarmist. And stay tuned because next week we'll be discussing the Mary Kay Letourneau case. The Alarmist.
Powered by Acast.
If you or someone you know is struggling with suicidal thoughts, there's help. Call the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline at 988.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.